long-awaited outcomes with remdesivir.
Is or is not hydroxychloroquine beneficial in COVID patients?
Should you wear a cloth mask?
And COVID on a cruise ship.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should turn directly to the New England Journal of Medicine for the publication of this trial that took a look at remdesivir and whether it was actually helpful for people with COVID-19. This study had outcome data on 1,059 patients, about half of whom received remdesivir intravenously and half of whom did not. The upshot of the whole thing for those who are sitting on the edge of their seats and haven't maybe heard about this yet is that the remdesivir group had a median recovery time of 11 days, while those who were in the placebo group had a median recovery time of 15 days. While this mortality data was not statistically significant, mortality by 14 days was 7.1% in the remdesivir group and 11.9% in the placebo group. Remdesivir, for those who need to know, is an inhibitor of the viral RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, so necessary for the virus to initiate and continue replication. With regard to side effects and discontinuation, there were quite a few people who actually discontinued for reasons other than death. They tried to stratify a number of different patients into this particular trial, including those hospitalized not requiring supplemental oxygen, hospitalized requiring supplemental oxygen, receiving non-invasive ventilation or high flow oxygen, and those receiving mechanical ventilation or ECMO. So, of course, when they have those different groups, the N drops a lot. And so the outcome measures based on the different groups kind of loses some of the power. So I frankly am looking forward to bigger studies. And of course, we're going to see those as the outcomes are prolonged with these patients. Basically, they say that their findings highlight the need to identify COVID-19 cases early and start antiviral therapy before pulmonary disease progresses to require mechanical ventilation. And I think that's a really important point.
A couple things about this study. This is just preliminary results. These are the results just in the first two-thirds of patients. In other words, they did an interim analysis, and based upon that, they decided to make remdesivir available. However, all the patients were enrolled, so the final data should be coming out over the next several weeks to months. Because oftentimes, when you just publish the preliminary data, it actually makes the results look a little bit better oftentimes than they are. As you highlighted, these individuals received treatment a mean of 19 days after they developed symptoms. So they're in the hospital already, because this is an IV drug that needs to be given in the hospital. And the patients that benefited most were those that were not very severely affected. That is, those that were either not receiving oxygen or those that were receiving oxygen. Those that required either a non-invasive or invasive ventilator didn't really seem to benefit. It would be nice if there was a mortality benefit. The numbers moved in the right direction, but it wasn't statistically significant. I guess what I'd say is this is not the magic cure. This alone is not going to treat COVID patients. It may be one piece of the armamentarium, but the results are fairly modest at best.
One of the things that this seems to point to for me is something I've heard clinicians talking about relative to timing of treatment. And clearly, timing of treatment here is better if it's early. And then there's that huge discussion regarding use of immunosuppressive agents that might be beneficial later on, after the virus has sort of finished its giant replication phase, and we want to damp down the immune response. So maybe it's going to be a two-parter, even a three-parter.
Elizabeth, your point's well taken. And also, we're going to need to throw in whether either other therapies, for example, convalescent serum that has antibody in it, maybe that should be applied to the sickest patients. So again, we'll get more information as more results become available. But it looks like if remdesivir is going to be beneficial, it should be in the earlier rather than the later stages of the disease.
Let's turn to yours again, relative to treatment in The Lancet. A look at hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine with or without an antibiotic for the treatment of COVID-19.
everybody's aware of the controversies that have been going on. Is it or is it not beneficial? And there are some randomized trials going on. This is not one of them, though. This is a multinational registry that analyzed the use of chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine with or without the use of another antibiotic called a macrolide, that is azithromycin or clarithromycin, in over 96,000 patients in 671 hospitals in six different continents. The nice thing about this is that in this particular case, the therapy was administered early, because some people thought, well, the hydroxychloroquine wasn't shown to be beneficial in other studies because they waited too late. But to get into this registry, you had to be treated within 48 hours of the diagnosis. If you're on a mechanical ventilator, you couldn't be enrolled in the study. If you're receiving other therapy, you couldn't be enrolled either. What they discovered was that individuals that received any of the antimalarials, chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine, with or without another antibiotic, had an increased risk of ventricular arrhythmias. They were more likely to be on a ventilator, and they had a higher mortality. The individuals that received none of those medications, the chance of them having a ventricular arrhythmia was less than 0.5%. But if you received treatment with chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine with or without a macrolide antibiotic, your risk was about 4 to 8%. The mortality for individuals that received none of those medications, about 9%. If you received chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine, your mortality was suddenly 16 or 18%. And if you added a macrolide antibiotic on top of that, the mortality was 22 to 24%.
And I'm really frankly hoping that this is going to be the last word on this, because this ongoing swirling controversy, of course, is deflecting attention from things that may actually be beneficial, and also creating this idea among the public that somehow these things are going to just magically arise that might be beneficial.
There were some valid concerns early on that the therapy wasn't effective if it was given too late, but this is clearly not given too late. This is given early in the disease process. And the World Health Organization has suspended their randomized trials right now until they have an opportunity to look at their interim data and also to examine this data more closely.
Okay, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. This isn't really a study. It's really a retrospective look at some of the data relative to cloth masks and whether they might be helpful with regard to interrupting transmission, really from somebody who is already infected, either to another person or to contamination of the environment. This, again, an ongoing controversy. Many people domestically, in spite of the fact that recommendations have been made that if one is in public, one really ought to have a mask on, many, many, many people are going without masks. So they took a look, as I said, retrospectively at this idea of, are these cloth masks actually helpful? Basically, what they found is, yes, they are helpful. They are able to stop some particles, especially those particles that are going outward from somebody who's infected to either another person or to the environment. They noted that when they looked at all the evidence, layers of cloth add efficiency. Studies showing that the efficiency in stopping particles range from 43 to 94%, but with two layers of tightly woven cotton material, 97% stopping of particles. So that's pretty good. In this ongoing controversy of both droplets and aerosols, they were able to show or look at the evidence showing that both droplets and aerosols can be interrupted by these particular things. The upshot of this is, hey folks, pick your fashion item of a two-ply, tightly woven cotton material so that you can wear it going forward. At least that's my public health message on this one.
The authors of this study were honest to admit that there was really no direct evidence that indicates that cloth masks are effective in reducing the transmission of the COVID virus. Now, it's not that they're not effective, it's just that we just don't have any evidence. So what they did was they reached back, even as far as several decades, to look at what they call the filtration efficiency. And that is, most of us are concerned about if we're wearing the mask, how much does it filter stuff coming in? They looked at just the opposite. And that is, if you're wearing a mask, how much does it filter stuff coming out? And again, the studies, even as far back as 1975, showed that good cloth masks, especially multiple layers, were efficient in filtering out upwards of 99% of the bacteria or sometimes viruses that were tested. Your plea is a good one. Wear a mask. A cloth mask can be just as effective as a surgical mask, especially if there are multiple layers to it.
And I don't think we need to say anything else about that one. I'd sure like to see everybody adopt this practice. Let's turn to your final one, and that's a look in the British Medical Journal at A very interesting captive population on a cruise ship and what that tells us about COVID-19 transmission.
I call this COVID on the cruise ship because that's exactly what it just was. As far as I know, this is the first instance of complete COVID testing of all passengers and crew on an isolated cruise ship during this pandemic. So let me describe what happened. There was a cruise ship with 217 passengers and crew on board that were due to make an Antarctic tour. They were leaving from Argentina. They planned to take a 21-day cruise around the Antarctic Peninsula. By the way, this was a very similar route taken by the British explorer Ernest Shackleton over 100 years ago. A couple days after departing, the pandemic became announced. So everybody on the cruise ship stayed on the cruise ship. They were not allowed to depart. And rather than having a 21-day tour, they decided to cut it short at 14 days. Well, the first 7 days, everybody was asymptomatic. And then on the 8th day, someone developed a fever. Over the next 5 or 6 days, additional individuals developed a fever, and the ship was not allowed to disembark at any of the places that it wanted to until all the people could be tested. So literally everybody on the cruise ship was tested. Interestingly enough, before they tested for the virus, in a couple of handfuls of individuals, they tested for the antibody and it was negative. But that's not surprising because antibodies can take several weeks after infection. So that was the wrong test to do. But when they tested for the viral particle, here's what they found out. 59% of the passengers and crew tested positive. Only about 21% of those individuals were actually symptomatic. Almost 80% of those individuals were asymptomatic at the time they were tested. What they didn't get into is why was that? Is it likely this was a false positive test? No, it wasn't. But these individuals may not have been asymptomatic, that is, never developed symptoms. They could have been in the pre-symptomatic phase. In that we know that they were exposed to other people on the ship that had the virus, they developed infection. And as we talked before, for the first 2 or 3 days after someone actually is infected, they may not develop symptoms, but they are still infectious to other individuals. And then they subsequently develop symptoms. We call that pre-symptomatic transmission. But what it does highlight is that a large number of individuals on the ship can develop infection. And what that probably means is if people are on a cruise ship and someone develops coronavirus, it's probably not safe to disembark that ship till everybody, that is all crew and passengers, are tested to determine who might be infected and spread it when they return to land.
Well, I think that the other thing that this illustrates is this really high rate of the potential for pre-symptomatic transmission.
And whether this ends up being pre-symptomatic or some individuals could go on to remain asymptomatic is really unknown at this particular time. You know, assuring traveler safety, whether you're on mass transit in New York or you're traveling in airlines, will certainly be considering the safety of passengers in the future.
On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices, including wearing masks.